my take is that if we have amendments, then we're back at square one.
State lawmakers move the gas line plan closer to a vote. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 21st of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a look at new ways for using coal.
This is not something new in the world, it's just new for us. But with half the coal in the United States, we should move forward.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Alaska has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who has been sexually abused or injured by priests or anyone working for the Fairbanks Diocese. The deadline is December 2, 2008. Claim forms are available online at dioceseoffairbanks.org or by calling 1-888-570-6269. This message is sponsored by the Catholic Bishop of Northern Alaska.
The House tomorrow will take up and vote on the bill authorizing a natural gas pipeline from the North Slope to North American markets. Before sending the bill to the House for further debate and a vote, the Rules Committee turned down three amendments to the bill. Those amendments would have stopped the project until concerns about the future development of the Point Thompson field are resolved, bypassed limits on the amount of gas that could be set aside for in-state use, and protected the state from any liability from commitments that TransCanada might have. The possibility of changes would have brought into question the legal structure of the entire gas line project. Rules Chairman John Coghill says there's too much involved to put that at risk.
An amendment probably is an effective death knell to this bill.
Minority Leader Beth Kurtula agrees. She says the contract that TransCanada applied for was approved by the legislature when it originally passed last year, and it can't be changed this late in the process.
My take is that if we have amendments, then we're back at square one, that it undoes everything. It undoes basically the contract.
Kurtula says the merits of any amendment would have to be balanced with the likelihood of restarting the gas line project as if it were new.
Even if we all thought it was a great idea, it's not something that we can do because this is the deal that was put out for everyone to bid on. Everyone got to see it up front. Now TransCanada has made a binding agreement with the state, and the state's in the same binding agreement with TransCanada. So unfortunately, any little thing upsets the apple cart.
Coghill says the final decision will be played out on the House floor tomorrow when debate and a vote are scheduled.
I hope we don't go down that road. If there's enough votes to kill the AGIA license on a policy discussion, then that's what should happen on the floor in my mind. I am not interested in trying to kill it in committee.
But the committee was the first forum available. Majority Leader Ralph Samuels brought up two of the amendments. He voted against the original gas line bill last year and is opposed to its passage this year. He says the legislature should not allow itself to be put into a take-it-or-leave-it situation.
That's the problem with the processes that we've got right now. That's the flaw in a GIA in general. We get a take-it-or-leave-it thing. We go, well, we want to fix that wart right there. We want to fix that one thing right there. And then we'd be happy with it, or you're protected in the long run. And if you can't fix this thing with one bidder, then, you know, the process is that flawed. We'll see how it goes.
The bill will go to the floor unchanged, but the amendments and at least two others will be available for introduction on the floor tomorrow when a vote by the full House is scheduled. Southeast's commercial troll fishing fleet looks to be right on target for its king salmon catch from a five-day opening earlier this month. The summer's troll quota is determined by catch sharing agreements under the Pacific Salmon Treaty and how many Chinook were caught in the Southeast's winter and spring fisheries. The Department of Fish and Game's area troll management biologist Brian Lynch says the five-day catch should be close to the target of 61,000 kings.
It looks like we hit it extremely close, that the numbers will be right around 61,000. So we will be having a second opening in August. Timing of that has yet to be determined.
That summer king catch was less than half of the amount trawlers were allowed to catch in last year's first summer opening. It follows a spring fishery where trawlers caught just more than 36,000 Chinook. Nearly 50% of the spring catch this year was comprised of hatchery fish, one of the highest hatchery percentages in recent years. Lynch says the trawl fishery is seeing an impact from cold water temperatures.
It's really affecting how these fish are, their entry timing, their migration patterns, and their catchability, too, which appears to be affecting the coho catches right now. But the water temperatures are very cold, and as we've seen around the state, there's a lot of lateness to these returns, and I think we're seeing that right now in Southeast.
He says fish are not following typical migration patterns and are showing up in areas with warmer water.
It seemed that in general, where people were fishing, where they found a little bit warmer water, that's where they did pretty well. The fair weather grounds, which normally is a big producer anyway, appeared to be a big producer this year again, but the water temperature was a bit warmer out there too. So catches were much higher out there than they were in a lot of areas. There are also some other areas in Southeast and the, you know, towards the southern outside where the water temperatures seem to be a little bit up, that people did pick up a few more kings.
A second king opening sometime in August will target the remaining trawl quota of 26,000 kings. That opening will take place after trawling is closed for a short time to allow enough coho salmon to return back to Southeast's inside waters. Meanwhile, trawlers are out catching coho until then. Lynch says fishing for silvers started off slowly.
Getting a lot of reports of the fish are big, and bigger than about a pound bigger than they were at this time last year. Getting a lot of reports from people seeing fish on their meters but are unable to catch them. And that, to me, is somewhat of an indicator of a water temperature issue where they're just not biting as readily as they normally do. And coho seem to be pretty sensitive to water temperatures.
Coho prices this summer are averaging $1.38 a pound, similar to last year's price. King prices averaged $5.36 a pound in early July, roughly $2 a pound more than last year. At least three dead whales turned up in the lower Cook Inlet area over the weekend. Scientists with the North Gulf Oceanic Society were unavailable for official comment, but they did confirm that the whales had been killed by transient killer whales within the last few days. But officials with the Alaska Sea Life Center say they are not ready to confirm the cause of death as predation. Scientists were able to photograph the back flukes and retrieve skin samples from two of the three floating humpbacks. Exact locations of the whales are unknown, due in part to large tides and strong currents. Barbara Mahoney, a biologist with the National Marine Fisheries Service in Anchorage, says initial reports of the whales placed one floating humpback near Pearl Island and another off the shore of Chugiak Island. A third unconfirmed report places another dead humpback near Flat Island. Mahoney says necropsies could be carried out if the whales beach and they are easily accessible. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a renovation for an historic building in Anchorage.
It has very simple but strong architectural lines. Still has a lot of life. It has good bones.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Chariot Group, an authorized Polycom partner featuring HD conferencing solutions from its new conference center in Anchorage. Information at chariotgroup.com. Working late? Hear Alaska News Nightly at any time of the day on the web at www.aprn.org.
Local, state, and federal officials participated in a two-day strategic energy summit in Fairbanks over the weekend. The focus of the meetings was a synthetic fuel project being pursued by the Fairbanks North Star Borough. The proposed facility would turn local coal and potentially biomass into a synthetic diesel for heating, transportation, and electricity generation. Senator Ted Stevens says Alaska is well-positioned to take advantage of proven coal-to-liquids technology.
If you fly out of a plane today from South Africa, the chances are the plane you're on will use fuels that are made through a similar process. This is not something new in the world. It's just new for us. But with half the coal in the United States, we should move forward and we should demonstrate this.
A key element to moving the Fairbanks Coal to Liquids project ahead is gaining the support of nearby Eielson Air Force Base as a potential partner and fuel customer. Pacific Commander General Carol Chandler says the Air Force is the largest consumer of energy in the U.S. military.
In fact, we spent $6 billion last year on jet fuel, which comprises about 80% of our 80% of our energy costs in the Air Force. $12.5 million of those dollars were spent right here at Eielson. Now, that was at a rate of about $2.20 a gallon. Today, we're not quite paying twice that, but almost. So for that reason, I would tell you that we're very, very interested in new ideas.
The Air Force is already in the process of certifying its fleet of planes to use synthetic fuels. Senator Stevens says availability of a locally produced, lower-cost fuel could help protect Alaska military installations like Eielson from being targeted for closure.
Every administration, the last three administrations, have had a BRAC process. This next administration surely will have one. And one of the key problems for us will be that each of these bases in Alaska are very high cost because of the energy crisis. And I think that this project, if we can get going, we can demonstrate our willingness to the state, city, everyone be involved in making this project go forward. I think it'll have a lot to do with quieting down the cries for some type of elimination of one or more of our bases because of costs.
Stevens says $10 million has been added to the defense budget to pursue development of a regional coal-to-liquids plant at Eielson. He says it makes sense to invest in the plant, which could cost as much as $2 billion because high oil prices are here to stay. Congressman Don Young says the United States needs increased domestic production to stabilize energy prices.
We have to start producing energy today, from coal especially, and fossil fuels that are liquid, so that as the consumption rate goes up nationally and globally, that the price won't just get out of our reach and kill this economy. And that's what we're going to do with this project.
Among those also on hand for the Fairbanks meetings were U.S. Energy Department Undersecretary Clarence Albright, State House Speaker John Harris, Alaska Energy Authority Director Steve Hagenson, as well as Alaska Railroad and Usabelli Coal Mine officials. The synthetic fuel plant is currently the subject of an engineering study due to be completed in September. Rangers and entanglement specialists from Glacier Bay National Park are out on Icy Strait looking for a humpback whale tangled in a fishing net. Search and rescue controller Scott Giard with the Coast Guard says they've put out alerts asking any boats or aircraft that spot the whale to report it to the Coast Guard or to the Marine Mammal Stranding Network.
We got notified this morning of an entangled humpback whale that was entangled in a net and also a marker, like a little foam marker that they put on the nets. It was spotted yesterday about 3 o'clock just south of Lemmershire Island.
A Coast Guard helicopter that will be in the area will also join the search today. The Oscar Anderson House, Kimball's Store, the Anchorage Hotel, and the 4th Avenue Theater are some downtown survivors of the city's past. Soon, a new old-timer will join their ranks, the Alaska Railroad Freight Shed. KSKA's Len Anderson has more.
The shuttered building stretches 700 feet along the 100 block of West 1st Avenue. Its 50-foot width fits snugly between the street and a row of decomposing railroad ties. Above what once was the spur line, a 6-foot-wide unloading platform runs the length of the building. The exterior and the interior planked wall is one and the same. Inside, the floor is swept clean and mostly empty. The lighting from the exposed truss ceiling is frugal, with the air dank from age and prolonged idleness. The quiet is in marked contrast with the shed's past.
Let's walk down here and let's kind of look at how this building worked.
Paul Farnsworth, Alaska Railroad Project Director, wants to make certain his visitor appreciates the 1940s structure, not just as a building, but as a part of Anchorage and Alaska's past.
Before the Parks Highway, before even the Glen Highway was a goat trail, no Alcan, the railroad brought the freight in.
Farnsworth describes foodstuffs coming in through a trackside door and then out the opposite side of the building to trucks taking the goods to local stores. In the 1940s, most goods for Anchorage came by train from the port of Seward.
One of the realtors said that they came here to pick up their household goods when they got shipped in. They came to this building. At the same time, if I'm an Alaskan and I want to build a sluice box for a mine up on Denali, or send things to mines up on Denali or to Denali National Park or Curry, where we used to have the hotel, or Talkeetna, or any of those places, how did you get it there? There wasn't any road to go on. There's some mud trails. So what you do is you'd bring your freight in here, would put it in the boxcar, and then would run it up to Fairbanks and drop it off at all these whistle stops on the way as we went up there. So a lot of Alaska moved through this building.
In the building's first full year, 1942, the railroad moved nearly 420,000 tons of freight, much of it military supplies and materials. Gradually, shipping trends changed, and the 36,000-square-foot freight shed entered its current sustained hibernation. Farnsworth says that's about to change.
And looking at an opportunity to develop the community we want to bring from downtown off the hill and to revitalize the south side of Ship Creek, we've chosen this as one of our first projects, to turn this historic building into a LEED-certified office and retail space.
John Steele of ECI Higher Architects, the firm designing the project, says the transformation will be similar on a smaller scale to Seattle's Pike Place Market or Vancouver's Granville Island. LEED stands for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. A nonprofit group, the U.S. Green Building Council, runs the program, which promotes environmentally friendly construction, or renovation, and a healthy work environment. This would be the first historic LEED-certified building in Alaska. Steele says that means keeping the historic essence while making it an energy-efficient and healthy place to work.
It has very simple but strong architectural lines. Still has a lot of life. It has good bones. We're keeping the forms. We're keeping window openings, door openings. The appearance will have a little change in proportion, but it'll have the same look and form and materials as when it originally was built.
The interior will be divided and modified to meet the needs of the tenants. Jim Kubitz, Vice President of Real Estate and Facilities for the Railroad, says the over $6 million project is set to enter the next phase.
We are out the bid this week for the construction project. The bids will be in late August. If we get the go-ahead on it from our board of directors on the 1st of September, we will start construction this fall. Completion will be July of next summer, 2009. The tenants who want to move in currently want to move in by July of next year.
Three firms have expressed strong interest: ECI Higher Architects, Porcaro Communications, and Kaladi Brothers Coffee. This is Len Anderson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Railroad Corporation, with daily rail service to Seward, Whittier, Anchorage, Talkeetna, Denali Park, and Fairbanks through mid-September. Information available at alaskarailroad.com.
Fairbanks area home sales remain strong despite the national real estate downturn. Statistics released by the Greater Fairbanks Board of Realtors show only a modest dip in sales during the first and second quarters of this year. More than 400 homes sold in the Fairbanks area during the first two quarters. That's down 64 from the same period in 2007, but well above the levels of the prior 3 years. Board of Realtors President Amy Creer says the Fairbanks market appears stable.
We just have to see, you know, it's, as long as I've lived here, our economic trends have kind of been delayed from those that the lower 48 has been experiencing. So I don't think that we know for sure yet if, you know, we're out of the woods as far as the housing market thing goes or not. But I feel good about what's going on right now. So
area home prices increased over last year, except for three-bedroom homes, for which the average sale price dipped slightly to $221,000. Creer says statistics show more houses are on the market and they're staying there longer. She says energy concerns are factoring into the local real estate market. Energy efficiency is becoming a higher priority for people looking for homes in Fairbanks. Real estate agents say buyers are looking at fuel consumption records and for alternative heating sources like wood stoves. A team of Russians are setting up an amateur radio outpost on an uninhabited Aleutian island. KIAL's Ann Hillman caught up with them on their way through Unalaska and brings us this story.
Three Russians gather in a hotel room in Unalaska, toasting each other and their journey.
Four expeditions. One, two, three. Hurrah!
They've come from towns near Moscow, in Siberia, and in Washington, and are headed to the remote Chuganaydek Island, home to Cleveland Volcano, to set up a ham radio outpost. It will be the first time for ham radio enthusiasts, or hams, to make contact with the island.
And we came here just with one target, to activate one of the latest rare island, which is Chuganaydek Island.
Sergei Morozov, known as Romeo Alpha 3 November Alpha November on the airwaves, is a member of the Russian Robinson Club and is participating in the expedition. The club aims to set up temporary ham radio transmission and reception stations on islands around the world. Named after the famous marooned sailor Robinson Crusoe, the club has over 1,000 members worldwide.
Our society divided by two parts. One of them is an activator. Another one is hunter. The activator group very small, very little, as we do. And the hunters, they're looking who is in the island now. Especially, they're much interesting who is the first time on the island.
The group is traveling with almost 1,000 pounds of equipment and supplies, including transmitters, antennas, and power generators, to the island to activate it. That means allowing as many hams as possible from around the world to make audio contact with them. There's fewer than 10 islands on the planet that have not been activated. Anyone who makes contacts gets a QSL card, like a merit badge that confirms they succeeded. But expedition coordinator Yuri Shushkin says it's not as simple as just dialing in a radio frequency.
Of course, it depends on propagation, output power of station, our station, and their station, on type of antenna used, and the time of the day, of course.
Aleutian weather and ash from the Okmok eruption might make contact more difficult. It also might impair the expedition altogether. The group is having trouble finding an airplane or a boat that will take them to the island. But Shushkin says that's part of the fun.
It's not everyday traveler, but it's what makes it unique. It's not just a going to some beach in Mexico.
It's not tourism.
It's something more to it.
Once on the island, the hams will participate in a worldwide Islands on the Air competition and try to make as many radio contacts as possible. The $30,000 expedition was funded by donations from communications equipment companies, hams, and the Traveler's Own Funds. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
Mariners in southern southeast will see a barge laying fiber optic cable between Ketchikan and Wrangell this week. It's part of GCI's $30 million project to connect five southeast towns to the company's cable link with the lower 48. It will replace the company's existing system of satellite and microwave relays used in Petersburg, Ketchikan, Sitka, Wrangell, and Angoon. GCI spokesman David Morris says the 270-foot barge started work in the Ketchikan area over the weekend.
About 4 days after that, we should be doing the Wrangell work, and then about 3 days after that, so on or about July the 25th, is when we should start doing the work around Petersburg.
The cable will be dropped on the sea ocean floor up Clarence Strait and up the Stikine Strait to Wrangell. From there, it will cross Sumner Strait to the southern part of Mitkoff Island and continue overland to Petersburg. Later this summer, the company will lay more cable up Frederick Sound and Stevens Passage to Juneau. Another segment will also extend from Juneau to Angoon and from Angoon to Sitka. The cable will be buried in some places, and in others it will just rest on the sea floor. Moore says the company will be broadcasting the barge's whereabouts during the work to alert other vessels, and will make the cable location available in marine charts once it's installed. He does not anticipate a conflict with Southeast's fishing fleet.
It's fairly benign. Most of the time when you have problems is when you have, some type of sideboard operation that's just on the bottom dragging things, and you just don't have that there so much.
GCI hopes the communities will be linked up on the cable by November. Dip netters lined the shores of the Kenai River this weekend as the subsistence fishery peaked. Alongside a few hundred other fishermen, KBBI reporter Emily Schwing fought the tide at the mouth of the Kenai River and brings us this story.
On Saturday night, just around 8 o'clock, the fish were hitting hard after a slow day, and the north beach at the mouth of the Kenai River was busy, to say the least. Gary Bratton is from Anchorage. I found him at the edge of the water untangling a sockeye from his dip net.
How many fish have you caught?
Not sure. I lost count.
How many years have you been dip netting?
Oh, about 15.
Fish were literally flying up the sandy slopes as dip netters tossed sockeye from their nets and jetted back into the water for another go at it. Laura Ofterhide, also of Anchorage, was fishing with her family. She said they'd be there until they caught their limit.
We have 8 of 100.
So we're fishing for 75 for our household with a 25 proxy for a senior citizen.
Terry Hecker is waiting for her son and husband to bring in the fish. She said they had a system going to process them.
They come in, my son bonks it, I clip it, and then they run back out.
Cindy Walker is Hecker's mother-in-law. She says this isn't the sort of thing they usually see where she lives in California.
It just seems like Alaska provides all this for their people, and this is the real Alaska to us. We've been, you know, in other places, but the sightseeing doesn't do it. This is down where they live, and it's just the neatest thing. We love it.
Last Wednesday, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game reported 68,000 fish passing their sonar counter at mile 19 on the Kenai River. And since then, fishermen have been standing elbow to elbow in chest-deep water. Robert Begich is the area management biologist with the Division of Personal Use for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Soldotna. After looking at the numbers from this past weekend, he says there's still more dip netting to be done.
Yes, right now we're sitting at 238,000 past the sonar in the Kenai River, and our goal for in-river passage into the Kenai River is between 750,000 to 950,000. So we're still hoping to see at least 500,000 more fish at this day.
Fishermen were well fed by a Baptist church group from North Carolina who set up a tent on the beach and handed out free hot dogs and hot chocolate as part of a service group called Salmon Frenzy. Drew Tucker is a volunteer. He says the group aims to serve the fishermen so that they can focus on the fishing.
We are from Roxboro Baptist Church in Roxboro, and we just came to help the fishermen out, you know. They're out here fighting the cold and stuff like that, so we figured we'd do them a service just handing out hot dogs.
Despite gusting winds on Sunday and a slowdown of fish, everyone seemed to catch something. I, for one, had a net full of fish carcasses. The gulls seemed to appreciate it. Reporting from Kenai, I'm Emily Schwing.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Joe Vicnicki in Petersburg, Len Anderson in Anchorage, John Ryan and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Emily Schwing in Homer. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.